is, isn't it? Okay, so today is Monday the 25th of February 2008, and my name is Leanne Gould and I'm at the Prospect Art Gallery and I'm interviewing Anne Newmart. And Anne, you were one of the many famous babies that came from the Northern Community Hospital.
That's right.
So your family had a real presence in Prospect. Do you know when
I think it was just convenience. They are migrants from England, Scotland, and I guess Prospect Enfield then was relatively cheap to hire places in. Not higher places, but higher rent. Spaces in, and I think we said before all of my family lived in Clifton, Beatrice,
Emily Street. Rose, your
Emily.
Father grew up in Emily.
Yep.
Did
yep. So it was kind of a whole Prospect piece from both my in-laws on Dad's side and my in-laws on my mother's side. But then we moved down to Somerton Park, which was a beach suburb then. It was really just beginning. It was when he came back from the war and land was fairly cheap, he bought two blocks, built a house on one and left one as a tennis court. Not lawn, not bitumen, dirt. So it was very muddy. Yeah, very muddy playing tennis. But it was near the sea, which I loved, and there was hardly any houses around, and at night I could actually hear the sea rolling in and out as I went to sleep. But now, of course, it's so occupied and whatever.
You wouldn't hear the sea for the cars.
Oh, no. Oh, but you wouldn't hear it for all of the interference in between. But we actually moved into a space where there's nothing. Nothing at all. And we lived on Baker Street, which wasn't even built. And I remember my dad even dug the path up to Diagonal Road to make Baker Street possible. I remember him seeing him with a fork and spade shoveling all the weeds away to make the street. Yeah. So, yes, I guess I'm very local initially from Prospect, but Somerton Park, Grinnell, Jetty Road was my stomping ground, and it wouldn't be now because it's turned out really pretty awful, but it was then and it was fun.
It would have been beautiful back then.
Oh, it's great. Mm. Yeah. Walk along in our smartest clothes and up and down and pass boys on the way and whatever.
And you went to Adelaide Art School in...
I finished my high schooling at age 15.
Where did you go to high school?
Brighton High.
Oh, right.
Then Old Primary and then Brighton High.
Yeah.
And Brighton High was considered lower class because a lot of the girls were going to Woodlands private school that was nearby. So I lost a lot of connections. But I still made good collections at Brighton High. And a lot of people from Brighton High are now renowned as very good artists because we had the most excellent art teacher called Leonie Zuoff, who I'll always thank for my life. But I was forced to leave. I think we've been through this before, but never mind. Do you want me to say it again?
Oh, yes, please, because we didn't have
to. I was forced to leave school age 15, which was the leaving age for the official leaving age. And
so when would this have been? That would have been about 1960...
45 and 15, 60. So I went to work in a chemist shop for 2 years, 3 years I think, and I couldn't stand it anymore. Although I must say I learned a lot about mothers caring for their boys with teenage acne. And people trying to buy condoms, which my Catholic chemist didn't store. That was very embarrassing. When they'd asked for Durex, I said, "Do you mean sticky tape?" And I had to wear white from head to foot and whatever, and went to makeup courses and stuff like that. But After 3 years, I couldn't take it, so I thought I'll either be a nurse or I'm going for artist.
The reason that you had to leave school and do that, which we didn't talk about on the tape either, was that your mum felt that to be a good woman, you should be very quiet and just get a little job and then marry an accountant.
Well, my elder sister had already gone to art school and really kind of stuffed things up a bit. She moved out and was very bohemian and wore black clothes, bare feet, down to jazz clubs in Hindley Street and lived in a flat and had lots of pictures of naked men on the wall from her life drawing. My mother said, it's corrupted her and it will corrupt you and you're not going.
Did you both have the same upbringing, you and your older sister?
Well, 5 years apart, I don't think it could be the same upbringing. But she was a really incredible, vibrant girl. And she used to make the most incredible clothes to wear and sit on the back of motorbikes and jazz around. And my parents were very worried about her. And they didn't want me to be the same, so since I was the plain child, I had to go out and get a job to buy makeup and pretty clothes to attract someone. And I hated it. So I always wanted a career, and she says, no, no way for you. So I stopped at the chemist shop. It was a really traumatic time, actually. And my parents were away, and my elder sister was talking with me, and I said, I'm going to go back to school, which meant I had to give up my salary, my car, everything that goes with being responsible. I had to get back on a bike, collar my old friends for secondhand uniforms, but I was really well accepted at Brighton High.
So back to school, you went back and did year 12, year 11, year 12.
That's right, and I had so much help. And Lee Zurf, the only Zurf, the art teacher who I mentioned before, through all that time I was working in the chemist shop, I would go to her once a week and she'd set me the projects that were set at school and I would bring them up. She'd look at them and give me criticism and appraisals and stuff. And I actually put my work in for the exam and I got a credit. And when I went back to school, it was quite ironic because I was still one of her best students, but only got a pass. So I don't know what happened there.
She's building you up for bigger and better things, I think.
Yeah.
Must have been incredibly hard to, after 3 years, to go back into that school environment where all your peers had moved on and moved out, and returning to that as an 18-year-old must have been very difficult.
Well, I knew I was going to get somewhere, so it was all worthwhile. I was treated with a great deal of respect. They allowed me to design my own winter uniform, which is very basic, simple, bottle green, like the others, but I didn't have to buy one. I had my own design. And I was actually in classes with students that my sister, my younger sister, had been in class with. So I did have a number of friends or acquaintances there that were all younger than me but knew me because I was Tessa's older sister. And I did very well that year and they said, well, if you do well, you can go to Teachers College. And I said, oh, bugger. So I looked up the course and I could be an art teacher. So I chose to be an art teacher, which meant I could spend half my week at art school. But art teaching students were regarded as the lower class at the art school as opposed to the fine art students. I did 3 years there and didn't feel mature enough to go and tackle a class. So I applied for postgraduate year. And they're only giving four each year. And I got one. So I majored in design and painting, and then I actually had to work with fine art students. That was a bit of an anomaly for them to have a teacher's college student work with them. But I did so well, and then I was sent out teaching, and we were under bond, had a bond, and I had to work
three years off.
And I worked for 1 year. The first 6 months I was put in a demonstration school because I was considered a pretty good teacher.
Where was the demonstration school?
I was at Mitchell Girls.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and pretty lucky girls, really. Mm. And then after 6 months, they made half-time between Mitcham Girls Tech and Croydon Girls Tech. Such a difference. But I realised I was teaching students and putting all my energy, not so much at Mitcham, but especially at Croydon, that really didn't want to do art. You know, they'd rather throw smarties at the boys next door or, you know, wave their pants out the window. And I said, I'm not going to go on in the education department. One of my senior lecturers at Teachers College had said to me privately, I can't name her, I'm sorry, very quietly, she said, Annie, don't stay in the education department. It will kill you, and you're too good for that. So I applied for a lectureship, and I said, if I don't get it, I'm just going to resign. But I did get it, only after 1 year teaching, which was quite remarkable, and I was allowed to work off 2 years of my bond as a lecturer at the art school. And I told you before too that there were other lecturers there that had been seconded from the education department that were in fact my lecturers when I was a student, and that also applied for this position. So there was a few complaints when I got the job as a young female, etc. But nevertheless, I did, and they were appointed a few years later, but there was still some antagonism with a couple of them about me getting the job before them.
Was that then at the North Adelaide
campus? Yeah, when the School of Art was in North Adelaide. And then it became TAFE, and we had so many name changes, and now it's UniSA. But I was so scared because I was only a few years older than a lot of the students. And I remember one class I walked into for the first time, and they were graphic students, and I had to teach them perspective or graphic drawing or something or other, and they all were behind desks. And when I walked in, they just all were absolutely silent and just looked me up and down continually. And I felt like absolutely fleeing. But I didn't, and I gained their confidence, and we got on pretty well. But I was teaching a wide range of subjects, which was really good. And then in my lecturing, I...
What were you teaching besides the graphic arts? What other subjects were you teaching?
Drawing, painting, general drawing, life drawing, design, ceramics, all of the courses, actually. But then when Clifford Frith came from England, he got a job there. He was my biggest inspiration, and to this day is still my mentor. And he devised a course for the first year where everyone would experience everything before they decided where they go. So it was an absolutely multidisciplinary course. So all of the first years they did graphic design, they did drawing, they did general drawing, they did life drawing, they did design, they did photography, they did printmaking, everything that you could imagine. And a lot of those students who'd come in and said, well, look, I want to be a sculptor. And he would say, well, at the end of the first year, Common Course, tell me what you've decided. And he became, he wanted to do pottery. And he decided that he'll be a sculptor. And a lot of people did change their minds. They would have gone straight into their desired course, but with the experience of such a range, a lot of them changed their mind about where they wanted to go. And Common Course was a really hard, tough, and threatened the students' challenges. and they loved it. And all of my students since then have always said, Common Course was the very best year of my life. The hardest, but wow, it was the very best. And some of my students still today say the same thing. And it was great. And I had a baby during my first year there, and after 6 months I got tenure, which of course I don't give anymore. Mm. And so I was a permanent member of staff. And
that would have been fairly unusual for the time too, because I think that still back then being a woman would have been detrimental to obtaining tenure.
Well, I think I was, I mean, I have to say, Leanne, I think I was really lucky. One is that they wanted more women on their staff to look equal, but I also got quips like other staff pinching me on the bum, mm. and the head saying, oh yeah, there you are, barefoot pregnant in the kitchen, that's where you should be. Because then you didn't have to wear shoes. I wore old jeans and bare feet and my pregnant smocks. And a little bit bizarre, really, but it was lovely. And one lovely story I like to tell is when the rule came in that everyone had to wear shoes in health and safety.
Oh.
Yes, because some of the floors were quite dangerous. And I know I came back after that staff meeting at lunchtime to my class and said, OK, now, this is of credence. I don't agree with it. I think bare feet are fine. You get a bit dirty, but it's health and safety, just in case. And I was talking away with them, just in case you go and step on a drawing pin. And I went, ugh, and I did a drawing pin. Stuck right into the heel of my foot. Right in, and you know, they're a quarter of an inch long. And I was so determined to say, this might happen. So I wore shoes after that too. But it was a rule. There's also a rule of no public displays of affection in the corridors. Because there was one particular student who used to chase the women around and kiss them in the corners. But I mean, it was very different back then, and now the art school, I'm glad I'm out of it. It's become so conservative, so tight.
I think behaviour, general public behaviour has become so rigid, hasn't it?
There's
this tiny little window of acceptable behaviour, and anything around that is totally forbidden. And I think that it makes it very, very hard, especially for people who want to be creative.
It's true, and you can see it in the work that they're producing, that it takes a lot of courage for them to move outside of the square, if that's a term. I don't like using that term, but if that's a way of looking at it, that the various isms that have been around were and still are very tight. I know, as a student, I was told that you had to develop your own style, and until you do, your work will never sell or you won't be important. And I thought, what is my own style? How do I know when I've found it? Do I then have to keep painting in that manner? Style. Well, I had a style of dressing, which was crazy, and a style of wearing high-heeled riding boots one day and barefoot the next. And I didn't like the idea of that diagnosis. It also went along with the notion that the definition of art is that art is necessarily useless. And I thought, well, why does anyone do art if it's useless? So I challenged things with making, instead of hard-edge abstract paintings, I'd use figures in them. I'd still use my masking tape and whatever, but they're about figures and vulnerability. And I didn't like the idea of having to develop a style, and I never have. So I Every show I have now is quite different from the last, and if you look through that pile, you'll see so many things that are quite different. And even now, at the same time in the Fringe, the Raining Cats and Dogs work is so different from working at Nexus with tattoos.
So the Raining Cats and Dogs is the one that's presently out at Pepper Tree.
Pepper Tree. Yes. Pepper Street.
Pepper Street.
Pepper Street. Yes, and I had them up. I do a lot of work on hands because they're really necessary to me. Well, they're the most fabulous things we've got, and mine have cracked up, so I have limited use. What was I going to say from there? So I've never developed a style. I do what I want to do. I use the style or the means that is best to support the intention of my work.
Isn't that your style?
Pardon?
But then isn't that then your style?
Well, everyone says you haven't got a style, so the work's not saleable. So I don't sell much. But I also spoke jokingly, saying I have no style, very proudly, to the curator of painting at the art gallery one day, Jane Hilton. And I said, well, I don't know, you see everyone falling into a style and they can't get out of it. Especially if their work starts selling, they're obliged to keep making the same genre. And I don't have a style. She said, yes, you do. And I said, well, you can tell me what it is, because I don't know. And she said, your style is that everything is different. And I thought that was a really great confirmation from the curator of painting. Yeah, it actually gave me some credibility for working in different ways. Every show is different.
And that's true art, because it's constant new creativity.
Yes, but you see, it's not seen that way within the art world. It really is seen that you need to develop a... It's like a motor transport, you know, that you drive the same car. And it's very difficult. I know John Olsen was someone I met several times and stayed with him in Sydney when I was there. And he was very famous and had been given the commission to paint a huge round section of the Opera House, the Sydney Harbour Opera House. It's very dangerous to tell this story, but I will. You can either put it down or not. And he was the most frightened artist I've ever seen. He had achieved so much. I absolutely adored his work, Summer in the Ubute Country. He was my idol, but there he was, terrified. He says, I have to paint this whole mural in John Olsen's style. And he said, I don't want to. I want to do something different, but I can't. And his manager or the gallery that had him in his stable, because galleries have stables of artists. Interesting, they're called stables. Treat them like horses, really. Feed them a bit of hay, and they have to keep doing the same stuff. And he had to paint John Olsen. He said, I don't know what it is.
Makes you wonder where they turn it out from then, doesn't it?
Pardon?
Sorry. You're saying, you know, feed them hay and... Them. Where does the art come out?
I haven't used that analogy before, but I always thought about the stable as being a funny word. And it's still true. There's all the commercial galleries have their own stable. But then, back in the 70s, they used to actually feed them. They'd pay for their canvases, they'd pay for their paints, and they'd expect them to produce each year a certain number of works, of which they'd take their commission and keep feeding them more hay. But they actually, it was good in a way. If you got into a stable, you didn't have to go out and earn a living to supplement your artwork. The gallery, the commercial gallery, would feed them money. That's what I now called hay. And they'd be able to buy all the stuff they needed to work. And the better they sold, the more hay they got. Yeah. But it's not. There's still an element of that around. And I know I was showing with a gallery a few years ago, and he said, If you ever show another commercial gallery, I'll never show your work again. But it was okay, I could show at Prospect Gallery, I could show at community galleries, but not commercial galleries. And then he wrote me a letter saying, sorry, I've crossed you off my list. So now I can show wherever I want. And there are a lot of people that are crying out for me to show with them, so I have no worries about being dumped. And I just said, well, I think you're going to be sorry in a few years' time. I can't name who it was, but I was bold enough to say, you'll be sorry. Yeah, yeah. And where do we go from there?
You were talking about John Olsen and you're saying about how he wanted to do the Opera House a different way from what he'd been doing.
Well, he actually wanted to start painting himself, exploring different things. But the Opera House said, we wanted John Olsen. And that's an imposition. You know, if someone said to me, here's a big wall, I want an Anne Newmarch, I'd have to say no. I couldn't do it. And I had a culture exchange with China with another woman called Anne Morris to paint two large murals. And we didn't have any idea what we're going to do because we weren't going to paint our style. And we had to wait until we got there. And it was really hard to sort of decide what we're going to do. Mm. And they expected us to come with images of Australia and said, they said, we want you to show the one child family on a motorbike with their child in a transistor. And we said, I'm sorry, we didn't bring any images like that with us. Or maybe a motor car with the husband and wife either side and the child inside the car or being held by the mother. We had to say, sorry, we didn't bring any of those either. Anyway, we managed to do two absolutely beautiful murals. Unfortunately, I couldn't find them to put with the lot I've given you. But
when was that you did that?
Let's see, 86.
So that was long after you did the murals here, because that was back in...
Oh, yes. I think it was 86. It was a cultural exchange. The BLF in Melbourne and a wonderful guy called Jeff Hogg had arranged for the government to bring out three artists from China, and they painted a mural on the market of big green vegetables and lovely stuff. And that's because he knew of the Hussein painters who were being praised because each section of the community had to have their specific glorification. And Hussein, all the workers would come home at night and paint the products of the fields. They're beautiful. And they got real success at the Cannes Festival and were shown all over the world. And because of that, he was allowed to bring out three, to do this mural. And as a cultural exchange, there were two artists selected to go back to China, and that was Anne Morris and myself.
So what did you do? From what they were expecting, what did you then bring back?
Well, I took responsibility for the design of one and Anne of the other, but we both worked on both of them with three local artists, one who was a professor in Beijing, very high reputed, what they'd call fine artist, and another one who belonged to that cultural community and one of the Hussein painters. She chose, and we both worked on it, the notion of the good old Aussie postcard from the 40s that has little round images like a major scene and then those little inserts with little ribbons and all covered with native flora and stuff like that. But we used the workers in the factory as the central image. It was beautiful. And I chose to do a banner because I was involved here with the Art and Working Life banner project, and I'd painted a big banner for the Union of Locomotive Engine Men, which was great. There's a lot of banners being done that had been done much earlier, but the recreation of those for their demos and stuff. And so I thought I'd work on the banner idea. And pretty anti, because I thought the banner was like a Mao Zedong flag and too much Maoist. And I said, but this is a culture. You're wanting us to translate our culture art-wise in Australia to here. This is what's happening at the very moment with the Art and Working Life project. So I designed this really big banner, not red, blue, with a whole image in the middle of the Chinese working in the colour picture tube factory where we were staying, and then other things translating between the culture of Australia and the culture of China, and the whole script at the top was friendship between China and Australia. They didn't accept it at first because it was a banner, and I don't know if I'd done a red one or a blue one, but I did say at the meeting, look, I'll change it to pink if you want. You can have a pink banner. But in the end, they let that through, and they were very pleased with it. And it was a wonderful project. Hard work, but, yeah. We worked a 7-8 hour day, 6 days a week. And on the seventh day, we had a bus come and collect us, and they'd take us to show us all of the important historical parts, and was really, we were treated wonderfully.
What part of China were you in?
We went to Beijing first, and then we had an interpreter from the Beijing Museum, wonderful woman, who took us down to Xi'an. We spent a week down there, and or on the way, stopping at various cities and seeing old murals that were being restored, and a lot of the Buddhist murals and stuff had been just destructed, and now they're reconstructing them. And God, we saw some beautiful things, some absolutely beautiful things. And then we went to Xi'an, where our interpreter swapped, and we went to a little suburb or an out part of Xi'an called Xianyang, and that's where the colour picture tube factory was, and they had a whole complex, a building complex where all the workers worked, and they had a cultural centre and a theatre. And one of us worked in the, well, both of us worked in the cultural centre and in this enormous theatre. So it would have been as long as that, twice as high. Huge thing. A bamboo scaffold. Yeah, so we were put up in Xianyang and we were treated like princesses. But it was, yeah, it was hard work. But it was really worth it. And we believe that we were the first artists ever to be able to, in a cultural exchange, to actually paint something permanent on a wall. I don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly didn't seem to be happening everywhere.
Probably wasn't.
Yeah.
Break?
Yeah.
Back again. We've just had a quick coffee break, so, yep, and you just thought of something you were going to say.
Well, you ended on the note of how did I manage to do it with three children? And because my, I guess because I was interested in social things, and it was the feminist movement also at the time, and I was part of the women's art, forming the women's art movement, my child, my first child, was very important emotionally, so I painted that. And I guess rather than giving all my time to my children and leaving my job, because I didn't have anyone to support me, although I was living with someone on a huge salary, He gave me $4 a week, I think. So I had to both support him, basically, and my child. And I was now then given tenure, which meant my job was, secure. And I did a lot of work around pregnancy, and because all my work's very personal, I actually worked around images of the pregnant woman, the baby, the interior of households and stuff. So it became almost an inspiration rather than saying, I can't do my work because I've got a child.
Getting back to what you said about the start of feminism and you having your baby at this child and having your baby at this time and working, I would imagine that would have almost, at that time, you would have been one of the, one of the people that all the other women would have been watching to see whether it could be done or not, and there would have been an awful lot of pressure on you to be successful and to be able to keep it all together and to do that. And it must have been an enormous pressure to...
the women's art movement started in about 76, and I can remember very clearly sitting with Margie Dodd, who is also an artist, on the carpet in my house when we first moved in.
And when Jake, was this? This was in...
About 70... He was born 70... I forget the dates exactly. He was born 71. Yep. So we moved into the house in Prospect to work with Community 76. And me and Margie Dodd said, we need to do something about women artists. She had a child also. And got together a couple of other women and formed the Women's Art Movement. I was a little bit upset that they thought it was really a bit wrong I should have a boy child, but I denied all that. And so Jake was also part of my inspiration for work, and then Bruna came along and I started a 10-year project of once a year documenting the children, because they're all 5 years apart, Jake, Bruno and Jesse. So with screen printing, I also had a lot of other people working in the studio who also had children or not. And it became really important to recognise that as a woman, having children was a very important part of being an artist. And I guess I'd seen so many women who had left their art till their children grew up. And also I was teaching mature age students who'd come back to their passion for art after their children had grown up enough to leave home. So I guess I didn't do that.
One of the comments I made to you during the break was that I would imagine that it would be very, very difficult to leave something that's so important to you and to completely step away from that, and I think that there would have to be a certain amount of resentment towards the children if you completely cut yourself off from something that's important.
No, not at all. They felt totally involved in what I was doing. They'd give me advice, they'd give me opinions, you know. Toward the end of the series of 10 prints, after 10 years, they were part of making the imagery for me. I'd say, which photographs should I use this year? That helped me rack and helped me with the labour of screen printing. And that was one way, in a way, that the children became or felt recognised in the whole process of their mum being an artist. Instead of devoting my entire time to them, I also had a job. Now, that's just as bad as leaving them for a job. So I also had my artwork in the evening. And there was a group of women in Melbourne that I just loved called Bad Mothers. And I got their little card. They're bad mothers who kept on being artists through having children. And I'd have it on my desk and I'd say to little Jake, look, bad mother, 8:30, you go to bed. I'll read to you. Then you can stay up till 9, read to yourself or look at books. But bad mothers, I'm working from 8:30 or 9 onwards. That's my time. That's your time. That's my time. And they just got to accept that. But it was hard work because I got very tired, but I enjoyed my teaching so much that it didn't really matter. I mean, I got so much enjoyment from teaching. I'd leave in the morning exhilarated and drop the kids off to creche, come home in the evening and cook tea or share the household things with my partner. And I so much enjoyed my art. And they enjoyed being involved in it. And they always had pencils and crayons and lots of paper and paint. And so they'd be on doing their art thing whilst I'd be doing my art thing. And yes, I mean, it was hard, but I wasn't prepared to do what so many artists in history have done, is to leave their art because they were children. And I had an interview, I think, my first one-person show. There was a critic in Adelaide called Lou Klipak.
And when would this have been? What,
69. Yes, and I just got my lectureship. So I was a lecturer at the university. I hadn't had any children at that stage, because Jake was born 71. 77, yeah, 71. And I had my first major show, and he didn't review it.
Where was that held, your first major?
It was a gallery that now doesn't exist, called Ken Bolton, the Bolton Gallery. It was there for quite a while, but I had my show there. Another one at Llewellyn Gallery, which also now has changed. And I happened to see him at an exhibition opening at White Studio, which was really the place to be seen. White Studio was the real upper-class artists area. And we were in a kind of group of people, of my colleagues, other lecturers at the art school, and Lou Klipak. And I was really hoping he'd review it because I really admired his the statements he'd make, and his criticisms were really good. I was looking forward to it, and he didn't review it. And I said, quite boldly, I mean, you never really talk to your critics, so I said, Lou, why don't you review my show? And this is in front of about 10 colleagues. He said, because you're a woman under 30, and you can't prove that you won't fall in love, have children and stop working. Therefore, your work isn't seen or can't be seen as an investment. I was really quite stunned. He reviewed an 18-year-old student instead, who I've never heard of since, which is a bit ironic. But I had the wonderful chance to be able to say in front of him and all my colleagues, Lou, your fly is undone. Which he looked down and went, oh, yes it is. And he walked away quickly to zip up his fly. It's great. I think that's a really lovely story in my career. Lou, your fly is undone. Yeah.
When you started your family, I'm not sure whether we're jumping forward or not. I'm just having a quick look here at your curriculum, your CV. So, okay. Birth of first child, and then you went on to study philosophy and women's studies at Flinders Uni.
Yes. In my fourth year, I'd done philosophy one and psychology one. Then you're allowed to go to uni, which not very many people at the art school or teachers' college were allowed to. So that was just fabulous for me.
And that was out at Flinders, and I'm just trying to work out, by that stage you would have been living here at Beatrice Street, wouldn't you?
In the
tennis court? No.
No, okay. I was living in the hills at Milo.
Ah, okay. Beautiful.
Well, it's a long drive. No, after that I did philosophy 2, and that involved women's studies And I didn't do any more psychology. So after that I did philosophy two units basically in women's studies. And I found that really interesting too, because that was also a breakthrough for the university and for Professor Brian Medlin, who'd been, you know, the promoter of acknowledging women and women's studies as an important thing, but also the real breakthrough was allowing women who didn't have the qualifications to enter university to actually come along and do that course and be accredited for it. And he was also my partner and the father of my two children.
That explains why he was here back in the 80s sometime, was it? You had an exhibit here and he was here for that. You had an opening.
Yeah, probably. He died about 5 or 6 years ago now. Yeah. But we had a fairly tempestuous relationship for going on and off for 10 years. But both the boys are his, and my daughter is David Kerr's. So it's been a fairly interesting life. But as I said, my children have always been part of what I'm doing. I always like, I say to them, do you like this one? They're my best critics. I used to take them to art openings and say, what do you think about this? You tell me your thoughts. And it was really interesting because they had an appreciation and an understanding which was very simple. They'd say, I like that because, or they'd say, I think this one's crap. And it was really, they were really quite confident about expressing their views. And at one time we went to one at the Contemporary Arts Centre where this lovely woman had made a ceramic birthday party table. Everything in ceramic, all the little jujubes and the cupcakes and the whatever. And Bruno and I were looking at them, and then I was looking at a couple and talking to someone. He went off. And he obviously tried to pinch a lolly off the cake, and he came back and said, hey, this is a word he's just learnt. His newest word, he says, Mum, we're being duped. All of that's false. But I mean, you have to laugh at their
Isn't
responses.
Isn't that the difference in the perspective, though, that you would expect it all to be false and love the idea that someone's done that, and he's just absolutely.
Well, actually, showed the fact he's trying to nick a jujube or a cupcake.
Nice to know he's normal.
Yes. Yeah.
And then it was about then that your second child, Bruno, was born.
Yeah, that's just the one I was just talking about. Yeah. Bruno, and then Jesse. But I mean, it was all the same with all of them. I kept working through. Jesse was actually wonderful because Jake, I had 6 months off. Bruno, I took a year off, you know, pay without leave, leave without pay. And with Jesse, I had a fortnight off because I was artist in residence then. So I just took some time to recover my strength. And then she'd come with me everywhere. And of course, babies are the greatest things for communication with other people. And it was actually an incredible asset. And she seemed to enjoy it too, although she's very little. But baby on the hip, cute little baby, was so easy to talk to people, and that opened up so much, more than they would if it were just me, because, I mean, I believe sometimes I can be a frightening personality, but with a baby, it disappears, and they say, oh, lovely child. Yeah.
Would too, it opens a completely
and
new...
Also, I mean, this comes a bit earlier, I think in 75, with my CV, I said, I now refuse to show or have any more solo shows. I'll only work in group shows with a theme that I can work with politically.
But you had a solo show here in 2005.
2005? No, I said 1975. Oh, yeah, yes, but I mean, that's what I said then. I've had solo shows since, but at that point, 75, I basically let the art world know I was only interested in group shows. So I all of a sudden got invited to so many exhibitions that had a political bias or a feminist bias or a children bias or whatever, that I did a whole lot of work that was theme-based. And I love working that way, and that's the way I still want to work, which is why I love the fact of being Raining Cats and Dogs. It's, in a way, it's easy, and it's also nice to be have your work compared to other people's and be part of a network rather than your own solo shows. As he'll know, they're really hard, and you're totally responsible for everything, and the spotlight's on that person. And it's a challenge, a real challenge. So are group shows, they're a challenge. But and also like Adelaide Inc. at the Nexus with my tats. I'm only part of a small body or a larger body of people that are showing things that belong to them or aspects of their artwork. I was surprised, in fact. I became quite nationally known and invited to so many shows. And if you look on the CV of group shows, there's so many group shows that I put really important work in. And a lot of that is was shown in my retrospective.
Yes, there's a full page of selected group exhibitions. It's unbelievable. Solo exhibitions, there's a page of solo exhibitions and major public collections.
Yeah.
Reads like the who's who.
You just mentioned, as this person here would know, this gentleman here is just taking down his exhibit, and I've always thought that that must be one of the hardest things having an exhibition. You'd work so hard and there'd be so much energy and emotion put into that show, and it must build up to such a crescendo, and then taking down your work afterwards must be such a hard thing.
That's something that I'm working with, especially with Sandra, the PhD student doing anthropology. She came and helped me unpack, or actually pack up.
And she's actually studying you for an anthropological...
So she's taking a period of 18 months to look at what happens in an artist's life, etc. Which is really interesting. But we've found, rather than sitting talking, it's much better if I get her working for me while I do other things. The conversation is much easier, and... I guess she gets more information than if I were just sitting down trying to concentrate on what she wanted to hear. That's been interesting and a really strong friendship.
And you're talking to her about taking down exhibits and... finishing exhibits.
Well, how do you feel about selling? How do you feel about taking a show down? How do you feel about putting one up? What do you do in the meantime? Etc. So it's fairly full on. Yeah, it is at the moment.
Me too. So when did you move into Beatrice Street? Because you kind of moved around. Right. Because you lived at Aldgate, Mylor, you lived at Gilberton, North Adelaide.
Mylor, Gilberton, North Adelaide, and then here. I've only rented at Gilberton. The other ones are quite, houses I bought. And all of them not fit for human habitation.
I bet they had character.
Oh, I said character, but a lot of work needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have my salary, I must say I wouldn't be where I am today.
What made you decide to move back here? Because this...
To move here?
You didn't actually live here. Your parents and your family lived here.
Oh, no. When we were in North Adelaide, my studio was getting used so often by community groups, silk screening posters and things like that, that my studio became a bit cramped and a bit small and overused, and I had to say, no, you have to wait, etc. So I was looking for a bigger studio, and my partner was Brian Medlin then, and we were part of the progressive art world, the beginners, the founding members of the progressive art movement, which was a highly political group.
And by then, had you started the women's art movement as well? That was established as well?
That was about a year or two later.
And we wanted to, I mean, North Adelaide was such a mean suburb. It's quite incredible. The examples I think of is if someone had something stolen from their bag at the bus stop, everyone would just, and was frantic, everyone would ignore them and walk straight past. No one cared. But one of my first experiences in Prospect was a woman, a friend of mine, had a bottle of Coke stolen from her bag at the bus stop, and the whole area, even the deli owner, were out in their cars running around and just trying to get a bottle of Coke back for her kids because she didn't have much money. Whereas in North Adelaide, it was, you know, people have got money and they don't care about anyone else. But we're actually in North Adelaide. I was looking for a bigger studio, and we're looking at communities that we wanted to work with, and we're looking especially at Mile End and at Port Adelaide. And then this place in Prospect came up through a friend of mine, and it just seemed absolutely ideal because it already had a factory and
big space. Sounds incredible. It started off as a tennis court, and that was what, back in the 1920s, was it?
Probably. Yes, it's got a very old history.
The tennis court, he built walls around it and roofed it.
And then put a roof over the top. So it's all very illegal, and all the fences aren't on the boundary, which is
a problem I'm going to have to cope with
this afternoon at 5:30.
Ah.
But listen, I have to end this soon because I'm very soon due across at Norwood.
So what do you want to do? Well, we'll stop now. Back again. This is second disc of interview with Sylvia Kivlinix and Neil Hollett for the Country Women's Association, and you were just talking about the ACWW.
Yes, Associated Country Women of the World is a worldwide organisation made up of all the country women's associations, and their headquarters is in London, and they oversee quite a few projects for help in third world countries, mainly water being one of the big priorities of getting water available to women so that they don't have to walk so far to get it and carry it. And they've put wells in and tanks and given them all these incentives to help with that. Our South Australian group have gone, some of them have gone to the islands to teach the women there handicrafts and taught them how to use machines, and they've taken hand sewing machines over because there was no electricity in these places, and they've taught them how to make, one project was bloomers. And they said some of these women were fairly big and they had to make very big bloomers. They couldn't buy them, you know. And so they went over, about four of them went over and stayed with the people, local people, and taught them to use these machines to make dresses. They were just straight through muumuu type dresses they made, and these bloomers for them. And then they have each region, we're in the Southwest Pacific area, and that takes in the islands and New Zealand and Australia, and they have a conference every 3 years. It was in New Zealand last year, I think it was. The next one I think is going to be in Australia. They had one in Tasmania was last year, wasn't it? New Zealand was the time before. And when all the representatives from all these places come together and to talk about their problems, and then the main body then tries to deal with them. So it's giving help to all the islanders and people like that. And then as well as that, the Australian CWA of A, Country Women's Association of Australia, has forwarded to South Australia a portion of the $8 million given by the Australian government to continue our work in distributing this help to farming and farming-dependent families in drought-affected areas who are struggling to pay accounts for household expenses such as electricity, telephone, registration of the family car, dental bills, clothing and food for the table. Applications are coming in steadily with help being available for up to $2,000 over a two-year period ending in June 2008. And the South Australian Country Women's Association is doing this distribution of this money. But the Australian government also recognises that more than ever communities also need support. As well as help for families, there is funding available for community events. Grants are available to community groups, schools and not-for-profit organisations to help meet the costs of holding events that boost the morale and strengthen community bonds in drought-affected areas. So that's another one that is being helped by the government, but supported by CWA. In locally, then, each branch usually supports efforts in their own district if they've got people that need help or organisations that need help. We're not allowed to give money to anybody who gets government funding or who has national or has big fundraising things like or that sort of thing. But we wanted to give money to
Kilburn
School through the Prospect Blair Athol Lions group, who had been doing giving breakfast to the children at Kilburn School who were often coming to school without anything to eat in the mornings. And they started a project of going down there and giving them breakfast. And so we decided we wanted to give some money to that. And when I applied to state office to say that we were going to want to give them $200, they said, oh, you can't give it to Lions Club because they have all these fundraising things. And I said, well, we're not giving it to Lions Club as such. I said, we're giving it to them to help them feed the children in our area. And they said, oh, okay, that's all right. Well, as it turned out, we got a letter back from the Lions thanking us for the money, and they said, and we had told them not to use it where they needed to, and they said they were going to provide a wheelchair for somebody who badly needed it in this area. There were two people that they wanted to do that for, and they hoped that would be all right with us, so we didn't care. We'd given it anyway, so they could do what they liked with it. But that's apparently what they did with it. But we haven't done very much in recent times local projects because we haven't had the money.
So we haven't had the nobody's asked?
No, nobody's asked for any help. And
and you can apply for a grant to your council, for a grant, like the Prospect Council. But we haven't got any projects like that, so you don't apply.
No, so we haven't done anything like that. But we've always given our surplus money every year, even when we've only had 14 people or so, we've always had about $500 or so at least to give away at the end of each year. This time we ended up with, I think we had 800 something in altogether when we closed. And so we gave 200 to the Lions Club, and we gave 200 to the Emergency Services Fund. Another one that we always give to, always baby parcels, we always give $50 towards that because they have to buy quite a few things for baby parcels. But the other one that we haven't mentioned is Radio for the Print Handicap. And our girls do a session on that every fortnight. And they play the music for the CWA choir and they read from the magazine for people who don't get the magazine or can't read it if they do get it. And so we always give them a donation towards their expenses for going out there. And that helps with RPH to keep on doing their thing. What else do we give?
Well, every November we have...
Oh, yeah, Pennies for Friendship, yep.
That's pennies for ACW money.
Yeah, Pennies for Friendship started years and years ago with a woman in the islands, Solomon Islands, I think it was, who couldn't give very much. And she said if every woman in the world gave a penny or the lowest, smallest coin that they had into a fund, it would be a gigantic fund which could help disadvantaged people. So we started this Penny for Friendship. It's in November, and we usually take up a collection, and sometimes they'd say, well, if you could give the price of a loaf of bread instead of just the pennies. Every year we have a country of study when we study a country of the world. And about 10 years ago, the country of study was Australia. And so we said, what can we do for a November meeting? And I said, well, what's something typically Australian? Oh, barbecue. We'll have a barbecue, only we'll have it inside, cooked inside, but we'll charge everybody $5 to come in, and we'll all sit down to lunch together. So we started that, and the committee members, we had quite a decent sized committee in those days.
It's quite a considerable.
Yes, that's right, once. And so each committee member brought a salad, and we bought the sausages and we cooked them on fry pans, and onions in another fry pan. And then we just had tins of fruit salad and ice cream. And it was lovely to sit down, everybody, because by this time most of them are widows and they haven't got anybody home. They said, nice to sit down, put your legs under the table, somebody next to you to talk to while you're having lunch. So everybody was happy to come along, pay $5 to come in, and we'd make quite a good profit from that, and we'd put that towards our Pennies for Friendship. So the following year, when it was a different country of study, we said, well, we don't know about their food much, we'll still have our barbecue. So for about 10 years we've had this barbecue, and we've invited other branches to come to it, and we end up with about 40 or 50 people there, and it makes quite a decent amount of money to go to this project, which goes to ACWW. And so that's another thing that we do for worldwide. But of course now up here at Enfield, they just take up a collection. You put 20 cents in or whatever you want to put in. We took a collection last week. I still put my $5 in, because I would have done that if we'd had our barbecue. So I don't know how much they got from that, but they don't do anything special for it there, but I might try and talk them into doing something next year, perhaps. Don't know. But anyway, I'll get landed with the job of cooking it, I suppose. But no, they always, others that used to come over to it, they always enjoyed it, and so it was a good idea. It wasn't much work, really, if you had enough people to make the salads and things. And they all came up with different salads, too. There was
lovely
always some beautiful salads they'd come up with. So that was for that one. So most of our stuff has been for outside the area. We haven't done terribly much, but in the area. We used to always have a stall at Prospect Fair. For years we had a stall there, and that was our biggest fundraiser that was.
For us. It was great.
Yeah, we used to have craft and cakes and all that on that, and we did that for many years until we got too old.
First started, they asked us.
That was 83 when it first started,
well,
I think.
We
so that would have been 83 to 2003.
That's right. We went right through till then.
I don't know what year we finished, but one year we decided it was just too hard.
It's too hard when you've only got such a few.
And most of them, well, as I say, we finished up with four that sat in the front row together. We were between 92 and 96 years of age. Quite happy to come along and sit and listen and talk and have a chat, but unable to do anything as far as running the place goes. And as I say, we'd been doing it for so long over the last 20 odd years that got a bit too hard in the end. And trying to get speakers to come and talk to just a few little ones like that, you didn't feel that you could ask people to come and talk to a small group. And so they didn't seem to mind those that we did ask, but
really we'd been through every speaker you could.
Yes, well, we had been there over the years. So we just decided that we started talking about it at the beginning of the year, and saying that we thought that we would have to close. And, oh, you don't have to. We don't care if you keep going, you know, but they're all happy to keep going as long as somebody else did the work. And we still had to, you know, do all our books and things like that.
And it would be reports for the head office and everything as well that you would have to be preparing?
Well, we didn't have to do so much reports, but we had to do our finances by the book, of course. And that had got easier since they'd had central banking. We used to all have our own bank accounts before and put it in, and we'd have to write checks and things for what we were paying out. But when the GST came in, I think it was when they decided to have a central banking thing, so that you would bank in a central account, which was state office. It was still classed as our account. It was kept as prospect account, but we had to just send a form in to say what we'd banked each time, and then it was credited to our account. Well, a lot of branches thought, oh no, them down there, they've got all our money now, we can't do what we want to do with it. And it wasn't that at all. The whole idea was that the money would be, instead of being $1,000 in this one and $10,000 in that one, the whole lot would be out there where they could invest it at higher interest rates, because they would have $50,000 to invest. And that was the idea, to make money out of it. But we could still access our money any time we wanted it, and which we did. But a lot of them started opening separate accounts and things to try and hide their money, so that them down there couldn't get in touch with it. It was just so silly. And now they're still asking in here, with, they've got what they call a sludge fund or something, money that they has been banked. Nobody's sent in a form to say who banked it. They know it was banked at a Savings Bank of South Australia, but not where. And until somebody sends a form in to say that they banked this money, of course they're not getting credited for it, and so they can't get hold of it. Oh, there was so much controversy about that when they tried to bring that in, but it was the best thing that ever happened, really. It made your bookkeeping a lot easier. And but you're trying to convince people who'd been looking after their own money for so long. Wasn't easy.
No, I imagine it wouldn't be.
And it was a big job when GST came in, of course. And now that we're an incorporated body, have been for quite some years, you've got to be accountable to the government and everything, and your auditors. And so they say, oh, they're getting too picky about the money and all this sort of thing. But they've got to be, because they could be audited at any time. And if they got caught doing the wrong thing, they'd be in real trouble. And the whole state would be then, so they've got to be careful. But a lot of people think they've gone overboard with it.
I think they have to protect themselves.
But anyway, so that's, I don't know what else we can tell you much about it, but it's been a long, long, hard travel the last 20 years.
I imagine it would have been. I think it's very interesting that you started out with 12 people and you finished off with 12 people. The first meeting, you had 12 people there, and it's gone the full circle.
So it's been the whole spectrum, up to 134, I think, at one stage. So that was in the real heydays.
And that would have been in about the 60s, would it? 60s and 70s? That would have
been probably around about that time. Well, yeah, well, there was 108, as I say, when I took over as secretary, treasurer in about 74, 75, something like that. There were 108 then, but it had been higher than that before then. So,
Sylvia Newell, thank you very much.
Thank you for your patience with us.